You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This, of course, is Matthew Raphael Johnstone, as always. And this is going out on the 2nd of August, 2023. I'm engaging in a donation appeal recently. And many of you know that that blue box, whether it be on the Rush Journal site or the Orthodox Nationalist at WordPress.com, etc. The Orthodox Medievalist, of course, that's the name of my website, and that's a donation box for me, as well as things like Cash App, and the Orthodox Nationalist has all of that on there. I don't know if you guys know this, but my very infamous cat, Stanley, who's seven now, had a brother, Marcel. And right after my honeymoon, he disappeared. And that was a year and a half ago. That's February of 22. And yesterday, he returned in pretty good health. I think he's injured in one eye. I don't know what happened, but it was very hot, and he probably just had enough. So I'm in the process of reintroducing him to some animals that he doesn't really know. I've raised him since he was a little nugget of a kitten. Big tough bulldog of a cat. I just think that's extremely interesting, both just as a matter of course, and even in terms of theology, what that might mean. Where after all this time, I never quite let it go. Because I'm very close to these animals, but he came back when he damn well felt like it. So, anyway, that's a small piece of good news. It's these little things that keep you going in difficult times. On a completely unrelated note, I want to talk about the outlines of an Orthodox philosophy of history, world empires, Rome, and the Jewish Messiah in the prophecy of Daniel. I've been connected with topics like this for some time now. And in no way is this meant to be even remotely an exhaustive approach to what this means. Like Willis Carter always used to say, I'm just asking impertinent questions and giving a few examples as to answers. But because it's Old Testament, because it's a deeply political book in the prophecy of Daniel, it's abused by these Protestants, who, of course, it's an eschatological book, and that means Protestants are trying to mine it for their own Zionist agenda. And as always, they simply try to shoehorn the book of Daniel into what's going on now without much thought. But it's of specific interest to us because we're talking about history as such, politically speaking, in very, very broad strokes, as well as the end of history. Daniel is absolutely fundamental. You tend to think, and I think a few years ago I did the eschatologies of Ezekiel and Isaiah, just as powerful and just as inspired as the Revelations. But in the prophet Daniel, this is a central, and doctrine, and it is mirrored in the apocalypse at the end of the Bible, and Christ Himself referred to it in the Sermon on the End of the World, Matthew 24:15, and then also Mark 13:14. So God revealed to Daniel what will happen in the last days, and famously, of course, in the dream of the Babylonian king, this huge idol. And as is well known, the prophet relates this. This idol had a head of pure gold, chest and hands were of silver, his belly and his hips were copper, shins iron, its legs partly iron and partly clay. And it didn't really last long, as is common in Daniel, because until the stone came off the mountain without help of hands, struck the idol, his iron and clay feet and broke them. The iron, clay, copper, silver, and gold became as dust. The wind blew them away, and no trace was left of them. And the stone that broke the idol became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. And that's Daniel chapter 2. And, of course, Daniel interprets his own vision, but he has several others. So the prophet explains that these different pieces of this idol corresponds to four earthly kingdoms in some form of succession, after which, quote, in the days of those kingdoms, the God of heaven will erect a kingdom that will never be destroyed, and this kingdom will not be transferred to another people. It will crush and destroy all kingdoms and will itself stand forever. That's the same chapter. Now, according to the book itself, as well as the church fathers of both East and West, the kingdoms are mentioned specifically: Assyria, Babylonia, of course, Medo-Persia, the Macedonian Greek, and finally the Roman. But that, of course, is a patristic, later patristic understanding. This fourth kingdom is the most interesting as far as we're concerned, because it's the closest to us and matters, I mean, right up to the 20th century. It will take the final attack, the final attack of, or the assault of the stone at the idol's feet. And because this is normally associated with the Roman Empire, it will last until the end of days. That's not to say that it's eternal, but when it goes, the world is going to be rushing towards its end. And if there's any doctrine that has tons of empirical evidence behind it, it's that. And that belief you can read about, and many of you have, and say, for example, saints like Hippolytus of Rome, who I mentioned last week, John Chrysostom, Cyril of Jerusalem, Theodoret, and probably most importantly, in terms of detail, St. Jerome. But I also should mention the elder Philofer and Piskov, who helped craft the Moscow Third Rome doctrine. And he says, as is well known, the kingdom of Rome is indestructible, like the Lord was written into Roman authority. And what he means there is that it was included in the number of inhabitants during the census at Christ's birth. I've maintained the opinion for a long time that Christ doesn't do, God and Trinity doesn't do anything randomly. There's a very good reason that Christ was incarnated in a Greek-speaking part of the Roman Empire, a merger of many different peoples and languages, you know, Latin included. But I do want to make something else clear. Roman kingdom is the last one here. Can, remember, these things can refer, symbolism is very tricky, they can refer to more than one thing at the same time, so long as they're somewhat related. It can mean the empire as such, from the founding of Rome to Tsar Nicholas II, but it doesn't necessarily mean a territorial entity. It could also be understood as a successive idea of justice in the state, even if it doesn't manage to reach everybody. The Christian world is multinational. It's not cosmopolitan. It's multinational and multi-ethnic. And of course, the Orthodox Church is organized on an ethnic basis. And we've dealt with that many times in this program. But we're talking about the whole duration of Christian history, meaning the first to the second coming of Christ. Christ became a resident of this essentially universal empire. Again, it was multinational, with its core being Latin in Rome, but it does have a Greek root. The boundaries are are difficult to draw and they're not necessary to draw. One of the big errors of Protestantism is that they're trying to actually calculate using numbers and political rulers the coming of the end. And they have humiliated the church because none of their prophecies ever come true, and yet they're always talking about it. And so when someone who is more sober and who knows talks about it, you sound like a lunatic automatically. Now, God may use that for his own purposes, in that people are numb to calls about the end of the world, since it's so common and it's been going on for so long. I mean, Protestantism almost came into existence a very short time after the Lutheran revolt in the apocalyptic and utopian cults of Northern Europe, the Fifth Monarchy and all the rest of them. And of course, that's a huge error, but Christ empirically became a resident of this universal empire. Therefore, it's not crazy to say that it represents the unchanging truths of natural law, which of course is created by God, and it's linked forever with the future, with his history that's yet to come. So Daniel 7 also is of extreme importance. Again, it's a political chapter. And these four kingdoms, in some general chronological succession, and they will eventually all be superseded by God's direct presence. Now, in Daniel 7, something else should be discussed, and that is the beasts emerging from the chaos of the sea. The sea normally is a feminine symbol, the very opposite of Rome in the sense that it's always changing. And we've connected that with Venice and the marriage of the sea, and in the seafaring trading mentality, which is based on the sea. And the Ancient of Days sits in judgment over them. And from that, the Son of Man then rules eternally. The Son tends to refer to human nature, but it's not just any human nature. It's a deified one. And there is an angel, as always, who acts as an intermediary and to some extent an interpreter. Now, at some point, the last of the earthly kingdoms will make war on the church, and then at some point, the church will be granted eternal power. And that gets very complicated. It's a story of suffering and injustice that has a purpose. Christian history is interesting because it combines both the cyclical idea of the rise and fall of civilizations on the one hand with the linear idea of this suffering eventually unfolding into the end times and the spiritualization of all matter. It's also universally recognized. It is the product of the mid-second century B.C., with a very specific context, and it's one of the reasons I'm talking about it. The apocalypse, the apocalyptic mentality of both the Old and New Testament in many books often is put together to give comfort, to give assistance, a glimpse of hope to those who are suffering. That's certainly the case in Ezekiel, and it's the case in Daniel, because the context here is the oppression of the Israelites by the Hellenic ruler Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who reigned from 175 to 164 BC. He made war on the church of the day, outlawing the old law, many Israelite customs, and of course, very much like Solomon, built an altar to a pagan god, in this case Zeus, directly right in the temple. One of the variations of the abomination. And this is where the Maccabees come from, because this kind of thing leads to the revolt. The Catholics have two Maccabees, we have four. But it does make, I remember the first time reading it, and it's very exciting reading. This is the militarized nationalist, religio-nationalist uprising that we talk about all the time. As always, the very opposite of anything approaching pacifism. Now, of course, modernism is that pagan statue, and we are like the three boys or young men in the furnace. All of these metaphors are talking about the same kind of thing. Modernism, heresy, Judaism, Judaization has invaded the church, as we all know. But unlike the times of Antiochus IV, because of our confusion, the lack of identity, psychological torment, and of course, abulia, there seems to be no popular uprising. The sea, the feminine, the multitude. The sea often refers to that chaotic, easily manipulated, impressionable element in humanity, is agitated, and it's agitated by the winds of heaven. And from this chaos emerge four beasts. That is, and they use beast because it is referring to some extent to subhumanity. And they're associated with, the first is a lion, actually the female lioness, with the wings of an eagle. The second is a bear. The third, a leopard, also with wings and four heads. And then the fourth isn't described specifically. It's just a generic beast with 10 horns. And they sprout another one that overthrows three of the original 10. Again, I don't like the idea of getting bogged down with these numbers. Numbers are icons. They're a hypostasis of a form. In fact, in many cases, it's synonymous with a form. They're not necessarily numerals. Sometimes they are, but that's, I think, the minority of cases. Symbolism was the language of the ancients and the medievals. And one thing that modernism is illiterate, it's symbolism. And we know that because, as I've said before, modernity defines symbol as somehow the opposite of substance, which is absolutely not true. Something is symbolic because it doesn't have any meaning. But the church, reading scriptures without a substantial fluency in symbols and their meaning, including numbers, not much is going to make sense. But ancient medievals were quite literate in this respect. This is one of the reasons that reading the Bible, especially for these very prosaic Protestants, is a dangerous thing. Or worse, they believe that these symbols are the arbitrary inventions of the primitive mind, as moderns like to reassure themselves. Now, why these animals? A lion, and that's without gender, is a solar symbol, and therefore connected with Apollo and human reason. Generally speaking, it's positive. Now, the fact that the lioness has the wings of an eagle is fascinating because normally ancient depictions of a lioness are opponents of the eagle. It's a curious combination. One is the king on land, the other rules the air. The lion, in general, shows reason's eternal struggle against darkness and falsity. She is a warrior. But the eagle is also a solar symbol, at least most of the time. They're beasts, of course, but intelligent ones that can be harnessed for good. But listen to Jerome, St. Jerome here, who I think wrote the treatment with the most detail. And he is, you know, traditionally the authority on this chapter in Daniel. He says this: "The kingdom of the Babylonians was not called a lion, but a lioness, on account of its brutality and cruelty, or else because of its luxurious, lust-serving manner of life. For writers upon the natural history of beasts assert that lionesses are fiercer than lions, especially if they're nursing their cubs, and constantly are passionate in their desire for sexual relations. Moreover, just as a lion occupies kingly rank among the beasts, so the eagle among the birds. But it should also be said that the eagle enjoys a long span of life, and the kingdom of the Assyrians held sway for many generations. And for the fact that the wings of the lioness or eagle were torn away, this signifies the other kingdoms over which it had ruled and soared about in the world, or stored above in the world. So here, the lion slash lioness is an ambivalent symbol. Saint Jerome sees it as negative. Brutality and cruelty aren't, in no way, are positive. They're, by their very definition, bad thing. But because it's female, not just a lion, but a lioness, it partakes of chaos. And then Daniel, the lion, was, quote, raised up from the ground, and she stood upon her feet like a human being, and she was given a human heart. And Jerome argued that this applies to Nebuchadnezzar, and he says it is very evident that after he lost his kingdom and his power had been taken away from him, and after he was once more restored to his original state, he not only learned to be a man instead of a lioness, but he also received back the heart which he had lost. End quote. But then he also notes that it may refer to his kingdom as such, rather than the crowned head. And in that respect, St. Jerome says that it signifies that after Belshazzar was slain, and the Medes and the Persians succeeded to imperial power, then the men of Babylon realized that theirs was a frail and lowly nature after all. End quote. Now, he's referring to several things. But before I say that, I want to point out that it's very difficult to reduce an entire empire or civilization to a few words. Now, even today, nations have symbols, often from the animal world. Everything from, you know, bulldogs to bears to bald eagles. Of course, the Byzantine and Russian symbol, Montenegro and everywhere else in the East, is the double-headed eagle. But there's a few things. Number one, these can refer to a specific kingdom. And number two, it can refer to the ruler, the monarch, himself symbolizing the kingdom. Now, so that the fact that this lioness was given a human heart is a form of regeneration. So in that sense, it's not a bad thing. And by the way, I've never heard that lionesses are passionate, as St. Jerome says, in their desire for sexual relations. I've never come across that. Although it is true that they tend to be more vicious when taking care of their kittens. Now the bear. In alchemy, the bear corresponds to prime matter. That is to say, matter before it's formed into anything. It's inconceivable, but both in Christian and in Aristotelian metaphysics, it exists. Prime matter, then, refers to the instinctive drives that are often in opposition to reason. And it's been considered a symbol of the perilous aspect of the subconscious. And very much like the lioness before she's redeemed, it's also the attribute of someone who is cruel and crude. Often, the bear is found in the company of the goddess Diana. It's seen as a lunar animal, and hence, almost by definition, is female. The bear has three rows of teeth that devour flesh in abundance, and St. Jerome makes note of this. And he claims that this is associated with the silver part of Daniel's other vision. Because the idol, you know, had these metals from gold to the top, to clay and iron mixture on the very bottom. But here's what St. Jerome says about that. In the former case, the comparison was based on the hardness of the metal, in this case, on the ferocity of the bear, for the Persian kingdom followed a rigorous and frugal manner of life after the manner of the Spartans, and that too, to such an extent that they used salt and nasturtium in their relish. I don't know what that is. But for the three rows or ranks that were in his mouth and between his teeth, one authority has interpreted this to mean that allusion was made to the fact that the Persian kingdom was divided up among three princes, just as we read in the sections dealing with Belshazzar and with Darius, that there were three princes who were in charge of 120 satraps. But other commentators affirm that these were the three kings of the Persians who were subsequent to Cyrus, and yet they fail to mention them by name. And then he concludes by saying, therefore, the three rows in the mouth of the Persian kingdom and between its teeth we must take to be the three kingdoms of the Babylonians, the Medes, and the Persians, all of which were reduced to a single realm. And of course, the devouring flesh in abundance does refer to the persecution of the church. Now, the leopard is normally an attribute of Dionysius. Just like the first two, it's a symbol of ferocity, but a virtuous form of ferocity. The leopard, like the tiger, the panther, expresses the aggressive and powerful aspects of the lioness without solar significance. And this is why it represents the Hellenic kingdom of Macedon. Now, Jerome notes that the leopard has four wings like a bird and four heads. And as I've mentioned many times before, the number four is a traditional number of death or imprisonment. It's a square without an opening, like a prison cell. And Jerome connects this with the bronze kingdom in the other vision of the idol. And the four heads refer to the four major generals from this empire, post-Alexander: Ptolemy, Seleucus, Philip, and Antiochus. And Jerome says that the wings are a reference to Alexander's brilliance and military ability. But you notice St. Jerome talking about authorities and other authorities, which at the time he doesn't name. So he doesn't want to come down, for the most part, with a hard and fast interpretation. The boundaries, the conceptual boundaries here are very fluid. They're blurred, which is perfectly acceptable when you're talking about symbolism that's covering a very large empire. Now, the Ancient of Days, and this is something that Daniel watches. He takes his seat on the throne of heaven and sits in judgment, and then he puts that fourth beast to death. That is when the Son of Man, or Christ, Logos, reason in creation, is granted his eternal rule. So in one sense, the first four kingdoms are impermanent. And whatever their virtues, and they had several, they're still based on the will to power. They were empires. They were expansionist empires, which almost inherently are based on the will to power. But the fourth beast, the ten horns, the ten kings of the last and greatest earthly kingdom, and there'll be an 11th, which will overthrow three of them, and hence make war on the church. So St. Jerome doesn't pull any punches here, though. He says the fourth empire is the Roman Empire, which now occupies the entire world. And he says it corresponds to the beast of iron. He says, I find it strange that although he had set forth a lioness, a bear, and a leopard in the case of the three previous kingdoms, he did not compare the Roman realm to any sort of beast. Perhaps it was in order to render the beast fearsome, indeed, that he gave it no name, intending thereby that we should understand the Romans to partake of all the ferocious characteristics we might think in connection with beasts in general. The Hebrews believe that the beast, which is here not named, is the one spoken of in the Psalms. A boar from the forest laid her waste, and a strange wild animal consumed her. That's Psalm 79:14. But he does note that the Hebrew reads, all the beasts of the field have torn her. Well, they are all included in the one empire of the Romans. We recognize at the same time those kingdoms which were previously separate. And for the next statement, devouring and crushing and pounding all the rest of the pieces under his feet, this signifies that all nations have either been slain by the Romans or else have been subjected to tribute and servitude. So St. Jerome is referring to several things here. Rather than simply the persecution of the church as such, he is referring to simply coming under Roman dominion. Which, as I've said a million times before, Christ didn't seem to have a big problem with. And the way that Pontius Pilate is depicted is very sympathetic, and his wife even more so. Now, if in fact the fourth beast is a boar, as at least some of the Hebrews of Jerome's day said, its symbolism is similar. It is uncertain, though, much less so than the others. You see it as audacious bravery, the courage that almost becomes suicidal. So really not courage, just foolhardiness, but also licentiousness. And it was a basic a concept in Babylon and a symbol in Babylon. But my dictionary of symbols, which I use a lot, note that of the 12 labors of Hercules in the Greek tradition, the fourth labor was to subdue the Erymanthian boar, a violent monster that terrorized anyone he could. And yet this boar, while ferocious, was very easy to neutralize, since Hercules shouted at it And in its surprise at hearing this, the boar was shackled. And it's interesting. It may be a coincidence, but in the myth of Hercules, the boar was the fourth labor, as it is, or possibly is, the fourth symbol for the fourth empire in Daniel. So, the Old Testament is a highly political and, of course, highly symbolic set of writings. So much of it is, in fact, entirely political. And that's where modernism and official liberalism has some trouble, which is one of the reasons it's ignored in general. Because there is nothing leftist or inclusive or any of these slogans about the political system of Israel or anyone else. Therefore, it's generally ignored or rewritten and reinterpreted. You know, the modernists think that they're embarrassed by the acts of Moses or Elijah. But the overall theme in Daniel, among other places, but Daniel in particular, is God's sovereignty over history. History has a purpose and it has an interior meaning. And then as now, written and now read to encourage the church that was undergoing persecution at the hands of Antiochus IV to such an extent that it led to the Maccabean revolt. Now, in the late 7th and early 6th centuries before Christ, the Middle East was Babylonian, or at least heavily influenced by it. And even, you know, Judah, after the division of Israel, was a client, either directly or indirectly. But it didn't keep them from rebelling. And eventually it became the Babylonian exile, and that Babylonian exile became the intellectual foundation for the Talmud, among other things, but that was one of the origins of the Babylonian Talmud. And then in 538 BC, Cyrus permitted them to return to their former lands once the Neo-Babylonian Empire was conquered. And then following Alexander's death in 323 BC, as we mentioned, his generals divided the empire amongst themselves, and that's the origin of the Greek-speaking kingdom in the Middle East and North Africa. As Rome was, in fact, the last empire that Daniel mentions, it is important to note that it didn't take long in the ancient world for Rome to become a positive symbol, to the point where all European monarchies of the Middle Ages, even the early modern period, in some form, took their title from Rome. Rome was the standard of legitimacy, and was so until the revolutions of the 18th century. Now, Jerome, of course, you know, beats referred to political regimes in general, not just specific examples of empires. You know, the ten horns can apply to many things. And getting bogged down in that is dangerous. Now, the little horn is said to be Antiochus himself, with the three horns overthrown, Antiochus being fourth in line to the throne, becoming king after his brother and one of his brother's sons was murdered, and the second exiled to Rome. And he was responsible at least for one murder, but Daniel actually holds him responsible for them all. So it's noteworthy, not just that Christ found himself in this empire, found himself in Rome, on the fringes of the Roman Empire in an Aramaic and Greek-speaking area, but on the eve of Christ's incarnation, the Roman Republic was providentially transformed, even overthrown, into a monarchist empire, infamously by Octavian. And even the name Caesar became a title, not just a reference to a person who came later. So Rome was chosen to be a Christianizing force, and in anticipation of that, we get the concept of the restraining power. The restraining power that exists until the coming of Antichrist and the end of the world, and that was attributed to Rome. So whatever the symbolism in Daniel, there was a different conception of Rome that wasn't just the Roman Empire that existed and centered in Italy, but Rome as a broader concept that in fact involved at least three major cities. And there were others who took the Third Rome title briefly. Tver in Russia was one. Even Bulgaria, Turnovo. To the concept, of course, you know, it found its home in Moscow for a very good reason. And that's the final resting place of the Roman idea. So we're not talking about a specific empire. We're talking about the concept of natural law. So the restraining power is positive, as we've said so many times before. But there are negative features. This is the Iron Kingdom. This is the kingdom of the last days. And then once it's destroyed, the last days then start to accelerate. And we know the Talmudic elite see Rome as the enemy of enemies. But you do have some concept that Rome, at least in one conception, is the stronghold of Antichrist. So Revelation 13. Many of you know what I'm talking about. And it connects to some extent with Daniel. A beast with seven heads and ten horns. On its horns were ten diadems, and on his heads blasphemies. And the dragon gave him his strength and his throne and great power. And I, that is John, saw one of the heads mortally wounded, but this wound was healed. And the whole earth marveled, watching the beast, and they bowed to the dragon, who gave power to the beast. And a mouth was given to him, speaking proudly and blasphemously, and power was given to him to act 42 months. And it was given to him to wage war with the saints and defeat them, and power was given to him over every tribe and people, language and nation. And all who live on the earth will worship him, whose names are not written in the book of the life of the Lamb. Now, I skipped a few sections there, but that's very familiar. The beast was granted power against the church while, at the same time, gaining power over, quote, the whole earth. Now, five chapters later, you have an explanation. Seven goals are his essence, seven kings, of which five fell. One is, and the other has not come, and when he comes, it won't last long. And the beast, which was and is not, is the eighth, and from among the seven it will go to perdition. Ten horns, ten kings, who have not yet received a kingdom, but will take power with the beast like kings for an hour, and they have only thoughts that will transfer power and authority to the beast. This is meant to be a counterpart to the vision of Daniel, although in this case, of course, in more detail. Because you have to synthesize the apocalypses in both the Old and the New Testament, you can't really have a hard and fast association with a metal or an animal or a specific empire. Because empires are, again, not just the empire as such, not just the crown head, but the idea, general idea, that motivates it. Now, the number seven comes up all the time. It is, generally speaking, not a numeral. It's not seven of something, although occasionally it can be. It can be seven of something and also symbolically seven. And I think that's one of the better known numbers, because it is a symbolic completion. 7 days of creation, six being, you know, working the earth, the seventh, the day of rest, the removal of the seven seals at the end of the world, seven angels, seven trumpets, seven bowls, seven thunders, seven ulcers, a whole bunch of things. The Lamb, Christ mentions in Revelation, seven horns and seven eyes, the seven spirits of God sent to the whole earth. Seven stars, seven angels of churches, seven lamps, etc. refers to the spiritual fullness of the Orthodox Church as universal. And of course, the seven sacraments. Now it's conceivable, and there's a Russian tradition here, that the seven heads of Antichrist mean the total opposite of the seven churches and seven spirits of God, a symbolic image of all the anti-Christian forces of history that Satan uses. Everything from the pagan emperors against the first Christians, Antiochus, as we mentioned already, Muslims against Byzantium, Freemasonry and the French Revolution, Napoleon against Russia and monarchy in general, straight up to Bolshevism and Jewish liberalism in the USA. I'm uncomfortable talking about seven specific empires or three specific crowns. That's too sloppy of a concept, because the boundaries from one to another are very controversial. So, say the ten kings at the accession of the Antichrist, it makes more sense to refer to just the main states of our day, voluntarily united by a single leftist ideology. See, ten is just, it's not just 9 plus 1, but it's unity that comes from oneness and an amplification of that unity. Because the symbolism really goes from 1 to 9. It could be amplified that way, 10, 100, 1,000. But you do have a point of view that the Iron Kingdom beast does not relate to Rome. That Christianity itself may be that rock that breaks the idol, that destroys the pagan world, either at the first advent of Christ or at the time of the Christianization of the Roman Empire. Problem there is that Christianity didn't destroy all these kingdoms, and it wasn't the last days at this point. So in Daniel's second vision, the iron beast corresponding to the iron part of the idol refers specifically to the last times. As 10 kings, they have to be contemporaries of the beast, Antichrist. For, as they say, they will take power with the beast like kings for 1 hour. And the beast, Antichrist himself, appears precisely at the end of history and is defeated by Christ at his second coming. So in this case, there's no reason to believe that these are, and many have said this before, they're not entities that are run by specific monarchs, but possibly a group of power centers unified by a single ideology or control by a single group. The overarching point, of course, is that suffering, unlike the Protestants with their rapture, is something that not only we personally have to go through, but humanity has to go through, or at a minimum, the church has to go through. Now, there's three concepts I want to bring up at this point. The first I've hinted at already. These archetypes found in the New and the Old Testament can relate to different phenomena at different levels of analysis at the same time. So again, it's not, Daniel actually mentions the kingdoms. But when you synthesize Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and Revelation, it's important not to assign, I should say it's not important to assign specific historical kingdoms, the predecessors of Rome, for the first three parts of the idol. It can be that, but it doesn't have to be just that. The final meaning is important, though. The Roman Empire, increasingly weakening at a certain point in history, completes earthly history when it comes to politics. In 2023, we're suffering the fallout of now 100 years of a world without principle, a world long without Rome, two world wars, and endless instability. You know, the idol, the top-to-bottom composition, is made of noble metals down to the less noble, right down to clay mixed with iron. And you see this elsewhere. It's a common symbol for the decomposition of the state without it necessarily, or at least exclusively, applying to the four kingdoms that are indicated there. But the very concept that this is an inanimate idol, that just by itself, and is eventually destroyed, of course we're talking about statehood as such. That the state, that we normally talk about government, armies, power centers, is a form that in and of itself does not have absolute value. It can have great relative value, but it doesn't have absolute value. Secondly, the Iron Roman Empire in Daniel doesn't seem to have a specific Orthodox period, because after the conversion of the empire, Orthodox statehood was already an integral part of the church very early on, where, you know, the sovereign was the bishop of those living outside the church. The church's external affairs, for lack of a better phrase. Now, the prophet Daniel only says that the eternal kingdom is being erected by God already in the days of those other kingdoms. So it implies the existence of both the Old Testament church and our Christian church throughout history to the end. So the church is spoken of elsewhere as the New Testament Israel and the people of God. Third thing, the last thing, this iron beast, this terrible appearance, is another way to explain it is seducing people. The seduction that Satan will steal from Christ, vast territories, and even using, you know, inverted and perversely, using the structures of Roman statehood for something that couldn't possibly be any less Roman. But you see it too in the fourth beast in the book of the prophet Ezra. You see the same thing. It's a different concept, but in book 2, chapter 11, 12, it's a three-headed eagle, which the Lord set to reign in this age. But of course, he began to oppress and to do damage to the peoples of the world. So let me try to clarify here. In the description that Daniel lays out, of that very last empire, the lower part of the idol. By the end of time, you have a dual concept. There's a separation because you have the external form, the formal cause, the two legs, the idol, you know, imitating a man, suddenly becomes dual. And then you have a dual composition, iron and clay. And yet, you know, it states very clearly, and this is Daniel 2, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaketh in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaketh all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou saw the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it the strength of the iron, for as much as thou saw the iron mixed with miry clay. And the toes of the feet were part of iron, part clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong, partly weak and broken. And whereas thou saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave to one another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. And that's from the Dewey Reams. The legs were interpreted as the eastern and western parts of the Roman Empire, a division that is critical for us. So in the strong iron that has less clay, you could see the restraining power that even right up until World War I, even to some extent in the Western monarchies, able to crush the forces of evil. Certainly, the forces of evil were doing everything in their power to overthrow them. And very shortly, the Protestant Reformation did the same, despite it being royalist in the beginning. The clay that mixes deeper down is this sign of spiritual weakening of the people, of the government, monarch, and the state in general. And the ten horns in Revelations, there's, of course, ten toes. The horn, keep in mind, is, you know, the horn is the call to battle, among other things. So think of it as a military camp, not too literally. So a horn is not just a monarch, it's a monarch on the march. And those apocalyptic horns, so to speak, arise from both parts of the empire. That when the clay mixes to such an extent that Rome falls apart, what results from it is power for its own sake. Something that Machiavelli and Hobbes laid out in the beginning of modernity that only really reached fruition in the beginning of the 20th century. But of course it had ravaged many other places prior to that. But even the western part of the Roman Empire, including England for several centuries, had its western succession in the Holy Roman Empire that later was divided into, of course, you know, Germany, Austria, you know, whatever, and extended Western European civilization to new places. So there was a spiritual continuity that passed from the eastern part of the empire through Byzantium to Russia, which, just like the West, degenerated into something else, in this case, the USSR. And then from that to its fragments. So the restraint, of course, is taken away when Rome falls. And then the iron is no longer used for the good it was meant to be used for, but it becomes Satan's instrument. Whether it be in the prophecies of Daniel and the Apocalypse, the ten horns are the successors of both lines of Roman statehood. And even part of the peoples of the three previous empires. Because the fourth iron beast combines all that have come before it. So, of course, Antichrist, Adam Cadman, will try to control the maximum number of people he can. You see the liberal imperialism of our own day. But, of course, not all equally. There are some countries that are just less important than others, and certainly many that have no Christian foundation at all. Now, we don't know, you know, we can't use modern states relative to these horns. I know the Protestants try to do this all the time. But the horn is either the state of Israel or even New Khazariah that embodies the Antichrist. And you know, we can't avoid the topic of Zionism. And I'm including things like, you know, the Hungarian, Madagascar, New Khazariah today, Old Khazariah, Birbizdom. The cutting through this horn was, at least in part and at one level, the birth of the Jewish national movement in Palestine as a result of the First World War by the decision of the League of Nations and to some extent was accompanied by this rooting out of the three empires that participated in the war, Russian, Austro-German, and the Ottoman. But, you know, again, this is speculative, and that can never be seen dogmatic, but at least it offers a scaffolding to understand global politics. But now, the exception of Russia itself, you have this oppression of most centers of resistance. We can't say that entirely, of course, but the mechanism of effective financial, economic, and even informational control of the world tells us that with a few exceptions that we have to support, the capital of this anti-Christian world moves from the U.S., which is presently the golem, to either the Talmudic state of Israel or New Khazaria, because we're talking about the descendants of the Khazars either way. Khazars dominate both in New York and in Israel itself. And it's conceivable, and I tend to be sympathetic to this, that they may converge symbolically in Ukraine. But of course, that depends on the war. We talked about that last week. The choice of Russia, similar to the choice of Rome initially. Its last mission, what I've spent so many hours talking about, Russia's last mission before the end of history, certainly can't be ignored. But of course, the propaganda war, I almost don't have to argue. The propaganda onslaught against Russia from at least the Crimean War to today, saying the same things over and over again. So there's clearly a continuity there. That at even a subconscious level, the Anglo-American understanding was that Russia was its dread enemy. And to a lesser extent, Germany, which is why the two had to be divided. This can exist at many levels, whether it be Daniel or the Revelations. You know, the Jews attempted to slander Christ, demons did. And then, of course, the Christian community in the eyes of the emperors provoking persecution. Then after the conversion of the empire, Lucifer's servants began to pass it off as this evil, the embodiment of evil. Even terms like Byzantine. And we've spoken, I think it was last week or before then, the role of Russia in Talmudic Judaism is significant. The interpretation of Daniel from the Talmudic point of view is just an inversion of what we're talking about. That this beast is an evil ruler who will oppose the chosen, and he'll reign on earth, but will be defeated by the God of Israel, or Israel as such. Pre-revolutionary Jewish encyclopedia, this future ruler is, of course, symbolically Roman. His name, you know, King Armillus. He recognizes, of course, the doctrine of the gospel, meaning the New Testament, fights against Jerusalem, namely themselves, and they will rise up against them at the end of days, and that's when the Messiah will come for them. Armillus, or Armillus, is associated with Romulus, the first king of Rome, making Rome the opposition to Khazar ascendancy. And the Talmudic tradition says Rome is Edom, the ultimate enemy of the Jews, and a most unclean place. So Armillus is their version. I mean, there's many names, of course, or Armillus, an anti-Messiah figure. Jewish eschatological thought, which is just the reverse of the medieval interpretations of Antichrist, conquering the world and centralizing his forces in Jerusalem, and will persecute believers until his final defeat at the hands of the true Messiah. But in the Jewish mind, the inevitable destruction of Armillus symbolizes ultimately this victory of good over evil in their messianic age. It's the Jewish inversion and perversion of the Christian idea. In the 7th century AD, you have this connection, the Sefer Zerubbabel. There's a connection there between Armillus and Heraclius, the great Byzantine emperor, because there are events that are described in there that correspond with the Jewish revolt against this great Byzantine emperor. At the time, the great enemy of the empire was the Persians, and in 613 they took Damascus, which was a tremendously wealthy place, and of course, as all contemporaries say, with the help of the Jews. Then they went on to seize Jerusalem in 614, they damaged the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the True Cross, and then they took much of Egypt in 617, 618. So the Jewish revolt, in one interpretation, is a way to assist the enemies of New Rome, and that is, in this case, the Persians. Whenever there was a Persian unit nearby, you would see a Jewish revolt, and they do whatever they could to support the Persians and kill as many Christians as possible. And then the 11th century, the Midrash Vayosha also describes Armelius. That was in its first known publication is in Constantinople in 1519, which is symbolic, but and it's interpreted in the Jewish Encyclopedia about Armelius, that he will be conquered after bringing great distress upon the Jews. But these are pretty important Jewish texts, and he is the connection between Protestant fundamentalism and Jewish nationalism is, it's the similar to Gog and Magog. In fact, the Sefer Zerubbabel says he takes the place of Magog. The origin of this man is the offspring of Satan and a virgin. Is in the Jewish Encyclopedia is regarded as questionable, but you know clearly it's taken from Christian doctrine. And I mention all this because we end up talking about the Protestant Judaizers, the fundamentalists, which is the in terms of the Goyim, the manifestation of this near the end for them. The world in their Scofield Bible, which was first published in its present form in 1907, simply dividing the world this way, Jews, the church, that is themselves, and pagans include everyone else, but especially Muslims, the Orthodox, and Catholics in particular. And they'll go so far as to say that the concept of Israel should not apply to Christians at all, as was the case for millennia, but only to the Jewish people on a racial and national basis, which of course is a heresy at so many levels it would take forever to explain. And the commentary of the 1975 edition actually comes out and says, talking about the Last Judgment, the trial of the individuals of each nation is carried out depending on how they treated the brothers of Christ, that is, the Jews. So apparently, here, salvation is earned only by and through Jewish power. I have a Russian source for that in particular. But such a theology can only exist at an age of this level of Babylonian confusion, with the ferocity of the lion and the leopard. And the Protestants, as you know, maintain that the Jews are the spiritual descendants of Abraham and are part of that same set of spiritual blessings. So to hold to this, though, they have to accept Jewish power and take it for granted and have to willingly ignore, the Zohar, the Talmud, and cannot really reference them. Their argument is absurd. But the final dominion of the Jews is the restoration of the state of Israel in the form of a messianic millennial kingdom as a Jewish Messiah emerges. Amongst the Jews, the eschatological idea is that the messianic kingdom is the last phase of the world marked by the domination of Israel over the entire universe. And of course, this golem, this Judaizing sect, and Judaizers have existed from the very beginning, is extremely important. But they're only going to be around as long as they're needed. And of course, the way that these people put it, the Jewish domination is necessary for our own good, the millennial kingdom of the blessed. And you see the Judaizing trend everywhere. Jehovah's Witnesses, the Adventists, the Baha'i, Masonic cult, Buddhism, and expectation of the appearance of this last Buddha, even neo-pagans, the age of Aquarius leading to the militant age of Aries. Even Pope John Paul II, the civilization of love, where he says the deep agreement between the church and Judaism in all countries for the sake of universal prosperity. And he scandalized Catholics in 1986, where he said the return of the Jews to their land should be recognized as a blessing and a conquest that the world cannot deny. It is a prelude to the era of universal brotherhood about which we all dream. The recognition of Israel as such an irreplaceable role in the ultimate plan of the atonement promised to us by God cannot be ignored. And this became, and many of you have read my work on Fatima, that they have completely overthrown their conception of the last days. Their apocalypse bears no resemblance to that. They have their own version of the rapture. But there has to be this Armageddon, this apocalyptic catastrophe, for this utopia to come into existence. And this is why the rapture is so important to them. And Russia, of course, and I mentioned, I'm not going to repeat it. Last week we talked about, you know, Russia, Gog and Magog, and the lie that the British created in, during the Crimean War, that Tsar Nicholas, of course, was Tsar Gog. And that simply has no, you know, the Protestants, you know, the dictatorial power of Russia, the confederation of 10 people. And then the head is healed, you see in Revelations, and a new dictator reigns as power is restored. He will subjugate the 10 kings. And it's not uncommon to hear this referring to Putin in general. And he will be distinguished, of course, by the hatred of the Jews and begin his attack on Jerusalem. He is the new Armelius. That's how the Talmud projects itself. And the current interpreters of the Talmud, including Protestants, without realizing it, projecting all of this onto the final evil ruler, which remains Rome, at least in a symbolic sense. The victory of Jews over Russia, the Jewish collective savior, will establish this millennial kingdom. This, to some extent, explains the war on Russia, because the war on Rome continues. And if you go back to last week about Gog and Magog and the nonsense of trying to apply that Rosh to Russia and the rest, but rather, you're talking about the war on the saints comes from Khazaria in one form or another. So I know this has been fairly confusing, but I wanted to take apart Daniel and to some extent the Revelations and take it apart piece by piece. And understanding, of course, the fourth part of the idol is the most important. We're talking about pagan Rome, but also Christian Rome that gets weaker and weaker as this clay is mixed in with the iron. This is part of a degeneration of the world. Iron is still strong, but nowhere near as noble as gold and silver. We live now, of course, in the camp of the saints, Revelations 27, 8. But we're at war with Khazaria. In my case, in, you know, an intellectual war. But it's not, especially as Russia is concerned. Khazaria versus Russia. It goes back to the reign of Svyatoslav. Anyway, everyone, thank you for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.